Treasons, Ciara, go dummy, go dunny, go money, get money, go Stewie Patooie, go Ciara, it's your birthday. I'm like T.I. riding with a Nunu. That's it. We're playing the next show, which is my science project. They're gonna break down the physics of scratching. No, I'm just. Nat!
Zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi everyone, and welcome to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Today we have a special edition of My Science Project for you. It's in honor of Black History Month, and today's programming is all about Black History Month. So we're going to do a few different things to recognize Black History Month and to celebrate the contribution of Black scientists. We're going to have a look at a few historically important Black scientists. You'll find out where the origin of the expression "the real McCoy" comes from. I also have an interview with a woman who's a Black scientist and a teacher, and we'll look at the problem of race and the science behind race and the evolution of skin color in human beings. If you want to get in touch with myself, Julia, your host, or my co-host, Anne, you can email either of us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca, and we'd love to hear from you. Although the history of Black History Month has probably been done to death already today on the station, since all the programming is dedicated to Black History Month, I thought I'd recap it just quickly so that we have a starting place for the rest of the content of the show. Now, Black History Month actually started with Carter G. Woodson, a historian, who proposed that there be an observance of the accomplishments of Black Americans, which led to the establishment of something called Negro History Week in 1926. It's thought that February was chosen as the month for this because both President Abraham Lincoln's birthday on February 12th and renowned abolitionist Frederick Douglass's birthday, February 14th, fall, obviously, in the month of February. So in the 1970s, the week became known as Black History Week, and it was expanded into Black History Month in 1976. Now, slavery actually existed in Canada from 1628 until it was abolished in Upper Canada, which is now Ontario, in 1793, and throughout the British Empire in 1833. Between 1800 and 1865, when the United States still had slavery imposed, approximately 20,000 Black people escaped to Canada via the Underground Railroad. Now, if we zoom fast forward to 1995, in December of that year, the Parliament of Canada officially recognized February as Black History Month in this country, following a motion introduced by the first Black Canadian woman elected to Parliament, the Honourable Jean Augustine, who was an MP, and who was at the time Parliamentary Secretary to the Prime Minister. If we go back only about 3 years to 2003, according to the Ethnic Diversity Survey that the government carried out in Canada, almost half of the Black Canadians surveyed said that they have experienced some form of discrimination or unfair treatment in the past 5 years. And that's pretty shocking in 2003, and a very, very sad comment on the state of affairs. Since this is My Science Project and it's a science show, I thought it would be more than appropriate to take a quick look at the science of race, and to have a look at the color of our skins as human beings or Homo sapiens, and to look very briefly at the evolution of this. If we go back to our closest non-human primate relatives, which are chimpanzees and bonobos, or the genus Pan, it's likely that, based on what we know of chimpanzees today, which is not necessarily always the case because there's a lot of evolution that's happened several million years worth, actually, between the time that chimps split from our lineage. But if you go back to that ancestor who was around the time of that split and then who gave rise to our human lineage millions of years later, it's more than likely that this proto-hominid was similar in skin coloration to the living chimpanzee, which is to be white or lightly pigmented, so sort of a white skin, and then covered with dark hair. Now, in chimps, exposed areas of skin vary considerably in color. It depends on the species or subspecies. But all groups have facial pigmentation that increases with age and exposure to UV radiation. And the epidermis of most non-human primates is unpigmented due to the absence of active melanocytes, which are the cells in the skin that give color. And probably the primitive condition for primates in general was to have this unpigmented skin. So what's interesting here is that chimps are unpigmented throughout their body, except for the parts that are not heavily hair covered and where they're exposed to UV radiation. And I raise all of this because there were a few papers published by either together or individually two physical anthropologists, Nina Jablonski and George Chaplin. And what's really interesting about their work is they took a very detailed look and a comprehensive look at how skin color varied according to exposure to UV radiation. So not simply latitude, as had been done before, because UV can vary depending upon either your altitude, so higher up you get more exposure to UV radiation, or it can vary according to humidity. So in more humid conditions where there's rain or mist, again, there's less exposure to UV radiation. And what Jablonski and Chaplin did was to track across the entire planet levels of pigmentation in populations and to then regress that, or basically compare it with the levels of UV radiation in those particular areas. They found that there was a really high correlation between the amount of UV radiation that a human being is exposed to and the darkness of the color of their skin. Now, there are two things that are counteracting in terms of selecting for darker or lighter skin pigmentation. The first of these is something that we all need, which is vitamin D, and we need this to help, for example, absorb calcium. So for this reason, you don't want to have skin that's too dark, because otherwise you can't absorb enough vitamin D, which comes naturally from sunlight. And it's thought that, in fact, women have lighter skin pigments because when they're pregnant, they need to have even more calcium than normal. So there's a natural selection for this, and there might even be sexual selection for this, in that guys tend to prefer, for whatever reason, paler women. Now, the offsetting thing to that is that, in addition to skin cancer, which the researchers don't think is too important in this case in terms of evolving, because basically, although there's evidence to contradict this, you get skin cancer later in life after you've had your kids. So it's really not that important in terms of your own fitness, which is the number of babies that you have. And the more babies you have, the fitter you are in the context of natural selection. But if your skin is too light, what you end up doing is having UV rays destroy folate in the system. And that's really necessary for survival, which is also vitamin B. So you can't go too light or you risk having your folate broken down by the UV rays. And you can't go too dark or you risk not getting the natural amounts of vitamin D that you need from the sun. So a vitamin B versus vitamin D sort of trade-off. Interestingly, in populations where skin color was either lighter or darker than expected for that amount of UV radiation, there were adaptations in diet. For example, the Inuit population in Greenland has skin that is darker than one would expect for the level of UV and the amount of vitamin D they'd require from the sun. But then it was found that this population subsists heavily on marine mammals, so they're getting their vitamin D from what they're eating, and they don't have that same incentive or that evolutionary pressure to evolve lighter skin tones. Another example is a population that was lighter than expected, but it simply hadn't been around in that area for long enough for this pigmentation to evolve. Conversely, there are some populations where they're darker than normal, and they just haven't had equally, again, enough time to lose the dark skin adaptations. Now, there's a real debate around what race is, and in fact, for several decades now, race has been argued to be completely irrelevant in a scientific context. We use skin color to determine race, and we do that because we're visual animals. And so what we see is what we base our impressions on. Think of even looking at how someone dresses. But it's a really arbitrary categorization, and in fact, there are many different physical cues that we could use if we wanted to determine a certain race category. And these include things like hair texture or eye color, even facial shapes. In fact, if you were to base race on something like fingerprint types, you would actually place most Europeans and Americans in the same category, which would be to have loops. And Mongolians and Australian Aborigines would be members of the whorls category. And if you ink up your finger and get a fingerprint, you'll see that if you either have a loops or a whorls pattern to your fingertip. 75% of all genes in human beings are identical in every person, and only 25% of these genes vary from person to person. So out of that 25% difference, 85% of that difference would be present even if two people were from the same ethnic subgroup, so pretty closely related. Another 9% of that total 25% genetic variation, that will come from individuals being members of, for example, a separate nation or tribe. You could even compare people from different countries, even in Europe, for example. And only about 6% of the difference is the result of two people from actually being what we would call separate races. And because of the social context of race, often people tend to marry within their own quote-unquote race and then have kids. So that could also be a big part of that 6% difference. So, scientifically, race is a non sequitur. It doesn't really exist, but of course, there are very much social definitions of race and all the implications that they hold. So, even though it would be really lovely to ignore race completely and say we're all the same, there's no difference, socially, that just isn't useful. And we need to address the differences as we perceive them. Interestingly, there was an article published in Current Biology in December 2006, and it was about a program that had been made in the United Kingdom called 100% English, and it was aired on Channel 4. And it basically took a handful of really proudly English people, people who were convinced of a white Anglo-Saxon heritage, and it looked at their DNA. And for example, Carol Thatcher, who is the daughter of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, found that she was 24% Middle Eastern in her origin. For example, Saudi Arabia and Iraq. And another comedian named Danny Blue, he found out that he was 10% Middle Eastern, 11% South Asian, and 37% Southeastern European. And 43% Northern European. And what was interesting is that he commented that, well, if you could trace back your ancestry two or three generations to England, then you could call yourself English, which is a Canadian who's only been, my family from my mom's side, and my dad's side even, we've only been here for a couple generations. I just figure anyone who's born into Canada is Canadian. That's just my personal opinion. But the idea that someone thinks that you need to be established in a country before you're even born by your family is kind of odd to me. But nonetheless, it really raised these biases that people had. And it showed, again, this nationalistic sentiment about what it is to be a certain race, a race of people that has to do with really nothing to do with the science and the genetics of it, but has more to do with what you think of yourself in your mind in a social context.
You know about this story? Why, when does it stop? I guess six African-American Secret Service agents assigned to guard the President of the United States refused service at a Denny's restaurant in Maryland. Now, Denny insists they don't discriminate, but still, you know, you gotta wonder when that chef's hat is pointed, you know? Everybody's sitting around eating that Grand Clan breakfast. You know, you gotta get a little suspicious. Yeah. Oh, that's it. Okay. Thank you.
Here tonight, enjoying themselves in spite of the cover charge. If you can spare a minute from your merrymaking, I'd like to have the pleasure of introducing the greatest living master of jungle music.
We just heard Branford Marsalis and Buckshot LaFunk off Buckshot LaFunk's album. This was a song called Breakfast at Denny's. You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. This is a pre-recorded show, but if you'd like to get in touch with me, your host Julia, or my co-host Anne, please email us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. Today is a special show for Black History Month, and we just finished looking at the science of race and how race is pretty non-existent when it comes to defining it in scientific terms and looking at the genetics involved and realizing that the number of genetic differences across the entire human species is pretty small regardless of what skin color you have. But I mentioned that there are social implications to race, and one of those is quite real and really worth considering, and that's how your genes, which correlate with something like, let's say, skin color, make you more or less predisposed to certain illnesses. And one of those is a heart condition, and particularly heart failure. And there was a case that came up, and it was published in Nature Genetics in July of 2005, where a drug was patented called BIDIL, or Bidil. And it was patented because it was supposedly specific to African Americans who had heart conditions. And the trick was that really this drug wasn't anything new at all. Instead, it was a combination of pre-existing drugs that the company claimed, the company was called Nitromed, was more effective for African Americans in terms of treating heart failure. It also claimed that it was really only African Americans who would benefit from this drug, but as I just mentioned, it was a combination of pre-existing drugs that had been used to treat heart failure in people of any race at all. Now, one reason why Nitromed probably did this, according to this Nature article, is that they were running out of their current patent on the medication, but they still had their patent on the race-specific drug until 2020, which means a lot more money for them instead of ending in 2007. What's really creepy about this case, actually, is that Nature Genetics first published this article where they discuss that 29 different medicines had been claimed to be more effective depending on race, but that there was no consensus after a peer review of these medications. But what happened was then publications as respected as the Times of London, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times went on to misinterpret this information and state that these 29 medications were shown to be specifically proven to be better in particular races, for example, African Americans. And what's even more creepy about this, which is a gross misrepresentation of the facts, is the idea that drugs can be administered for certain races, hence we then have categories of races, and that's a really slippery slope. If you decide that, well, this race is more predisposed to heart failure, so it's inferior, we're heading back to the place of eugenics, and that's incredibly disconcerting. But it's not so straightforward an issue as in race-specific drugs bad, because, in fact, there are these racial differences. For example, there is a woman named Dr. Olofunmilano Olopade, and she gave a lecture for the NIH's Black Scientists Association. It was, in fact, the John W. Diggs lecture. And she gave this lecture in 2002. She addressed, in part, why black women are more predisposed to breast cancer. That's just one example of where your genes can make you suffer some illnesses more than others or bear some diseases better than people with a different combination of genes. I think the take-home message here is that it's important to not oversimplify the situation and say, well, if you have dark skin, you are this race and you have this genetic profile.
Have you heard? The AMS has reopened the Sexual Assault Support Center. SASC has a great new location in rooms 119A and B on the main floor of the sub, right across from McInnes Field. And we have full-time hours now, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. Call ahead and make an appointment to suit your schedule, or drop in whenever the need arises. The SASC works within a feminist, anti-oppression perspective to provide support in the form of one-on-one counseling, accompaniments, advocacy, information, and referrals to male, female, and trans-identified survivors of violence. We also provide support and information for survivors' friends, family members, and partners. All the services provided at SASC are free, confidential, and non-judgmental. We work with you to identify and support your decisions about your needs. For more information, call 604-827-5180 or visit rooms 119A and B in the sub.
Just this week, I interviewed Dr. Lynette Segola, who happens to be a Zimbabwean black researcher who got her PhD in immunology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the UK. And Dr. Segola has her medical degree from the University of Zimbabwe. She's now in British Columbia, where she teaches at Douglas College, which is in Burnaby, and she's a biology instructor at the college. Lynette agreed to speak with me about being a black scientist and to share her experiences and her insights with me, and this is our conversation.
My experiences growing up in Africa, in what was Rhodesia and is now Zimbabwe, and turbulent race relations being an issue throughout my childhood. And my experiences from that background, together with black Africans being a majority. So some of these questions were interesting, but certainly did give me opportunity for reflection. And I realized that my experience may be different from that of an African American, for example.
Yeah, I mean, most certainly, I think that growing up outside of North America, you would experience things in a different filter, for sure.
Yeah, and that in turn adds the additional perspective of being an immigrant on the face of all of this. So, yeah.
I mean, in fact, you're not only black, but a woman and an immigrant on top. So, I mean, some people might say that's sort of a triple...
A triple whammy.
Yeah, a triple whammy.
And
so aside from the overt discrimination that you would experience, let's say, in Africa, in terms of actually the profession of doing science and training as a scientist, and perhaps even in your teaching, have you found that you've been discriminated against, or have you caught sort of waves of bigotry?
Well, it's interesting. I think that what part of the background that's relevant for me of growing up in Africa is that my parents insisted that education was an important tool to overcome some of these racial barriers, which in turn have economic barrier impacts. So they insisted and spent a lot of money, although they didn't earn that much themselves, to send us to good schools to make sure that we could have a good education, because that was something that they could give us. And what that did was expose me very early on to a more multiracial environment than otherwise would have happened for most young people, I guess, young black people my age in Zimbabwe. And my experience through that school system, which was successful, gave me a confidence that made me realize that I was a person before I was a person with a color, and that I was the intellectual equal of my peers. So I didn't have, you know, big burdens in terms of dealing with that, partly because in my mind I believe it to be true that race doesn't affect my intellectual capacity. So that, I think, has a significant impact on me and how I perceive things. However, I realized that in moving to Canada, as we said, the triple whammy of being black, being an immigrant, being a woman, and frankly, in addition, having foreign qualifications and foreign work experience, these are all additional barriers that work collectively. Being black is one of them, and I kind of, it's hard for me to set how much that factor alone is significant in the light of all the others, but I'm sure that it certainly has an impact. I mean, one of the things I get is when people first meet me, they say, oh my gosh, you speak English so well. And I'm a little bit confused by that. And I often kind of brush it off by saying something like, yes, we were very well colonized. But, you know, it's an interesting... and that obviously has many meanings. So it's a kind of interesting situation to be in. In my life experience, I can't really say I have felt being black as a distinct factor that's worked negatively against me. And in fact, when the people that I've studied with, the people I've worked under have got to know me, I think I would like to believe that what's made a difference in their continuing support of me has been the quality of my work and my capabilities. So I think that maybe if it is an initial barrier, that one can certainly do quite a bit to be in a position, to be effective and competent in a position, because I think that that helps to change people's ideas.
And of course, if you're going for particular jobs, the first stage would be vetting your CV. And at that point, no one would necessarily know your color. They might assume, but they wouldn't necessarily know. And I suppose then at the interview stage, someone would have to be quite racist to deny you a position that you deserved. And usually there are committees involved in the hiring process. So you're unlikely to get a whole committee that's going to be racially biased. I suppose it would be more on the job or doing teaching and maybe having certain students react to you one way or another.
Yeah.
Has that happened? Have you noticed that?
First of all, on the job front and the interview front, I mean, where I am now, I think, is a remarkable place. First of all, because there are people who were in my interview panel who were willing to look at something different. And their perspective, to me, was the recognition that diversity adds interest and adds an additional experience. And I think that, you know, the group of people are unusual in that. And I think it's really important. Part of why that is, I think, is that they have had life experiences outside Canada, outside North America, in developing countries even. So I think that gives them a perspective that gives them a broader outlook. I thought about the issue with how students perceive me. First of all, because there are not many black instructors. So that, you know, is obviously something that I think about. I haven't directly experienced specific issues that would suggest to me that my ethnicity is an issue for students. And again, my approach is, you know, I'm going to be good at what I do. And I try to pitch my conversations with the, you know, at the level of, okay, this is the science and this is the material that we're working with together. However, I was really fascinated to go to a presentation. It was a professional development activity by a woman from Seattle who had done a study on the impact of race, gender, and appearance on how students evaluate faculty. Mm-hmm. And really has clear evidence that if you are an ethnic minority, if you're black or you're Hispanic, and in addition, you're a woman, students have problems with those two issues and those two issues together in particular. So that if you are an ethnic minority, their expectation of you is that you really have to prove yourself in terms of knowledge and your confidence in the material. If you're a woman, they want you to be nurturing, much more so than my male colleagues and counterparts. So again, you know, it's not just an ethnic perspective. There are many factors that compound how people see you and perceive you.
Did they happen to mention if in this study they had just sampled, let's say, Caucasian students, or had they also sampled, like, I wonder if people who are in a visible minority share that same view about someone who looks different than they are?
I can't quite remember, and so I'd hate to be very definitive on that, but my recollection was a broad perspective. It was not just of one ethnic minority, but I don't have those facts and figures. The other side of this coin is, well, what about the students themselves? And again, I've been really fascinated to hear of studies where people have looked at teaching biology and really clearly identified the negative impact of being an ethnic minority on things like access to higher education and pressures in higher education. Oftentimes people who are ethnic minorities, in this one particular study out of the University of Washington in biology that I'm referring to, those people were often the first people to access university education, so had lots in their families, so had lots of pressures in terms of expectations, but were also more likely to be the people working as well as studying, and this has a number of impacts. So, you know, this obviously has implications in the future for seeing more ethnic minorities in science, if there already are barriers in terms of access to education and other issues like social conditions that require you to be working as well as studying.
This is a bit of out of left field as a question, but do you suspect, based on what you said in your experience, that perhaps, at least in larger cities in a country such as Canada, that maybe race isn't so overtly the discriminating factor, and yet it's more of what you mentioned, things like your socioeconomic background, those challenges to your time, to your energy, the resources that you can access, traditions of doing one thing versus another? I mean, what would you think about that?
Well, I think that there are compounding factors. You know, so are you more likely to be socially and economically disadvantaged if you are an ethnic minority? And I think if you look at the evidence, that certainly would suggest that. That's not to say that there are opportunities, and in theory, they are equal opportunities. I don't know whether the reality of that really does pan out.
It's difficult, too, because there are lots of, I suppose, white people who are in the majority, the visible majority, who don't come from rich families either, and yet there seem to be more white people out there doing science. But then again, they could also be richer white people. I don't know.
Well, I think that one answer, or one way of looking at that is, well, who are the role models that people have? I know in my environment, there are not many black instructors, black professors in the sciences who are role models. And I think that that role modeling is essential so that people realize that, oh yeah, I can contribute through science. So I think that in looking at how to redress some of these imbalances, apart from the obvious difficulties in examining this closely, because as you say, there may be as many poor white people out there as there are poor black people out there, is to recognize the compounding effects of social and economic conditions on people in general. You know, for those of us who do have the opportunity and take the opportunity to move forward, it's important to be role models that illustrate to young people that these opportunities do exist.
I think it's a really interesting point that you raise about the role modeling, because it suggests that in addition to programs to help with the socio or the economic problems or challenges that young people of any race or culture come up against, that perhaps role modeling is something that's been very neglected in terms of institutionalized governmental programs. I know with SCWST, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology, for listeners who don't know what SCWST means, I think one of the really important aspects of that organization is the role modeling and the mentorship and the camaraderie that we all get from that.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I mean, there are aspects of that that are very positive. One is just the networking that allows an exchange of common lived experience, realizing that you're not the only one in the situation. You know, of being a woman, for example, and facing specific challenges within science helps a great deal. The role modeling helps phenomenally too. I think it's interesting because, again, I don't meet too many black women scientists that I can have this level of discussion with so we can determine what our common experience is.
And in fact, it was incredibly difficult to track you down as a black female scientist or black scientist. I don't see them.
Yeah. And you know, this is why I think it's a shame is that in biology, I've been intrigued that just looking at the contribution of women to science research, and in particular, I'm thinking about mates' reproductive choices, if you look at the bird model, that before women biologists came on board in large enough numbers, much of the focus was on males and how the male determines the mate pairing. Only when women arrived did people begin to look more at, well, you know, what is the role of the female in selecting the mate? And to me, that means that adding diversity promotes knowledge and inquiry and allows different perspectives to be examined. And I think that this lack of diversity potentially has implications for perhaps even how we conduct science, how we think about science, and its relevance to a large part of humanity.
I would totally agree with that. Lynette, thank you so much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
This next song is called Virus. It's by Deltron 3030, which includes Kid Koala and Del the Funky Homo Sapien.
Global controls will have to be imposed, and a world governing body will be created to enforce them. Crises precipitate change.
Secretly plotting your demise. I want to devise a virus to bring dire straits to your environment. Crush the corporations with a mild touch. Trash the whole computer system and revert to super pirates. I want to make a super virus strong enough to cause blackouts in every single metropolis. Cause they don't want to unify us. So fuck it. Total anarchy and can't nobody stop us. You see, late in the evening, fucked up on my computer and my mind starts roaming. I create like a heathen. The first cycles of this virus I can send through a modem. Infiltration hits your station. No Microsoft or enhanced DOS will impede. Society thinks they're safe when bingo hard drive crashes from the rending. A lot of hackers tried viruses before. Vaporize your text like so much whiteout. I want it where file replication is a chore. Lights out, shut down entire White House. I don't want just a bug that could be corrected. I'm erecting immaculate design. Break the nation down section by section. Even to the greatest minds, it's impossible to find. I want to devise a virus to bring dire straits to your environment. Crush your corporations with a mild touch. Trash your whole computer system and revert you to papyrus. I want to devise a virus to bring dire straits to your environment. Crush your corporations with a mild touch. Trash your whole computer system and revert you to papyrus.
I have already planned. The plan is programmed into every one of my 1,000 robots. We will not hesitate. We will destroy the Homo sapien. Please stay where you are.
I want to develop a super virus, better by far than an old Y2K. This is 3030, the time of global unification, break right through they. Terminals, burn them all, slaves of silicon, corrupt politicians with leaders and their keywords. FBI and spies stealing bombs, dissipate their plans in their face and catch the fever. Everybody loot the stores, get your canned goods, even space stations are having a hard time. These keepers seek to take our manhood, which results in the form of global apartheid. Ghettos are trash dumps with
gas pumps exploded and burnt out since before the Great Union. The last punks walk around like mass monks, ready to manipulate the database or break through them. Human rights come in 100th place. Mass production has always been number one. New Earth has become a repugnant place, so it's time to spread the fear that's fun to some.
Long have we tried to extend our glorious empire out to the stars, only to be driven back.
Devise a virus to bring dire straits to your environment. Crushing corporations with a mild touch. Trash the whole computer system and revert it to papyrus. I wanna devise a virus to bring dire straits to your environment. Crushing corporations with a mild touch. Trash the whole computer system and revert it to papyrus.
To the Black History edition of My Science Project. I mentioned at the top of the show that we were going to look at some black inventors, some contemporary, but most of them quite historic, and to have a look at some of the things that they did. And it's really impressive and surprising and interesting, some of the facts that I found out when I was researching this. Important black inventors are many, in fact, and it's quite shocking that we know so little about them because they've contributed a lot of really significant stuff. If you ever use dry cleaning, you have to thank Thomas Jennings, who was the first known African-American to hold a patent, which he did for the dry cleaning process. This was issued in 1821. Benjamin Banneker, who was a mathematician and astronomer and also an African-American, published an almanac, and he compiled this based on his own astronomical observations and calculations. He also constructed the first striking clock to be made in America. Another black scientist is agricultural chemist George Washington Carver. He was born into slavery at the very end of the Civil War, and he eventually went on to receive degrees in agricultural science. And his contribution, or at least a major one, was to advocate innovative agricultural methods. And he developed hundreds of applications for various agricultural products, including the peanut, which is a massive industry. Two African-American scientists who have links to Canada are Charles Richard Drew and Elijah McCoy. Charles Richard Drew was born in 1904 and died in 1950, so relatively short life, but I suppose not for the time. But he made a tremendous contribution in that he was the father of the modern blood bank. And there's now a medical school to train doctors in LA that's named after Charles Richard Drew. Dr. Drew was a really talented athlete, but mixed with this, he was also interested in becoming a doctor, particularly because his sister had died of tuberculosis. And what he did was he used his athletic prowess to gain him a scholarship to Amherst College in Massachusetts. And after that, he went to McGill in Canada. Now, in 1934, he graduated second in a class of 137 with a Master of Surgery and Doctor of Medicine degree. He then went on to work at the Royal Victoria and Montreal General Hospitals. And this is where he started to develop his interest in blood. It was 30 years before this time that different blood types had been discovered and that safe transfusions had become widely used by this point. But the problem was how to store blood so that it was available whenever it was needed. Charles, of course, banged up against a lot of discrimination, but he was not put off at all, and he went on to study blood, and eventually what he discovered was that if you separate out the red blood cells from the blood plasma, you can store the plasma separately, which lasts a lot longer than whole blood, and you don't need to care about the type of the plasma. It can be used to save anyone in a transfusion emergency. Further to that, he even found that you can dry the plasma for travel and mix it with water like those Warner Brother cartoons, almost just drop a bit of water on it, and instant blood plasma. So this was fantastic because this was right around the time of the Second World War, and blood was desperately needed on the battlefields and also off. And this technique for drawing blood plasma made it so that this could be taken anywhere as long as there was some water to reconstitute it. And Charles Drew became the world expert on blood in his day. He was asked by the American Red Cross and the RAF in Britain to lead an initiative to get as much blood for the war as possible. And his research resulted in the first ever blood bank. This has actually gone on to save thousands of lives during the war years, and it became the foundation blood service that we know today. It's important to realize here that Charles Richard Drew, even though he was told that black and white blood was different and black blood inferior, as a scientist, he recognized that this was not the case, and thank God that he did. Elijah McCoy is an interesting guy. He's the reason that we have the expression the real McCoy. He was born in 1844. His parents were slaves in Kentucky but escaped to Canada through the Underground Railroad. And Elijah was born in Colchester, Ontario. Now, his family moved back to Michigan, and his father went to work in the logging industry. And Elijah became really fascinated with his dad's tools. He was always taking things apart, putting them back together, and his parents were really supportive of his education. And they saved up so that he could go to grammar school until he was 15, which for that time isn't that young. And then he moved to Scotland where he studied engineering. And then he came back to the U.S. and he had real problems getting a job because of his skin color. But what he decided to do was to take a job as a fireman for the Michigan Central Railroad. This involved shoveling a lot of coal onto fires to produce the steam to run the locomotives. You needed to also oil these parts, which meant that the machine had to be stopped every time to lubricate them. And to him, this was a problem to be solved. So what he did was he created this little bucket, which would automatically release oil onto the moving parts of the train, meaning that it could constantly run in safety. And he had a lot of problems trying to get this device recognized. There were a lot of people who made imitations, but the imitations were consistently inferior compared to Elijah McCoy's work. And hence people would begin to ask for the real McCoy, which is where we get that expression from. In 1920, Elijah became so successful with this that he established the Elijah McCoy Manufacturing Company, and he improved and sold his graphite lubricator as well as other inventions. And one of these includes the portable ironing board because his wife wanted an easier way of ironing clothes. The final black scientist that I'll profile in detail is named Dr. Katherine G. Johnson. And she was born in 1918 and she's now retired. And she has a really interesting history. She was born in West Virginia and her parents were incredibly keen that she be well educated. And they made sure that she could get access to education by even traveling across the state because of local segregation policies in schools. And Catherine got a degree in French and mathematics from West Virginia State College, and she graduated with the highest honors. And then she went on to teach high school in Virginia. She went on to the Langley Research Center later to become a part of a pool of mathematicians. And the Langley Research Center is where all the cutting-edge technology goes on for NASA. And so soon Catherine was transferred to the NASA Flight Research Program, which is super exciting. And she remarked in the 1950s that the computers wore skirts in that time because, as she said, the men were so preoccupied with the whole space race with Russia that all the computing and the mathematics, all this complex stuff, was left for the women. Hence, the computers wore the skirts. She was also a member of NASA's historic 1961 team. Her calculations placed the USA's first astronaut right on target, and she charted the course for John Glenn in 1962 and for Neil Armstrong on the moon in 1969. She also developed the first emergency navigation system for astronauts by mapping exactly where stars should be seen at specific points. And she was the recipient of many, many NASA awards during her time there until she retired in 1986. If you're interested in finding out more about Black History Month and the scientists that I've talked about, there are different sources you can go to. But one really great one that I used is the Planet Science website. And this is content that was originally compiled for Black History Month in the UK by a fellow named David Bromfield, who is a BBC presenter involved in science and education on both TV and radio. And you can Google Planet Science, or if you can grab a pen and paper quickly, the website itself is www.scienceyear.com/out there/black_history, and that will get you to it. But as I said, if you Google Black History Month and Planet Science, I'm sure it will take you to the right pages. There are other resources. The Canadian government is a really good resource for non-really scientific-based but interesting facts about Black history and diversity in Canada. There's also InfoPlease, which has some interesting stuff, including the note I told you about Thomas Jennings and the patenting the dry cleaning process. And About actually has tons of really interesting stuff about Black inventors, and that's inventors.about.com. This is a song called Black Hand by Canadian rapper Cadence Weapon.
Take a break where it is, cousin. Cadence fucking Weapon. Eight-step programmer. Listen. Sleeper's hand, I'm a pillow. Black hand like a thriller. Why don't you spit coke rap? Well, you gram into pillows. I was standing. Real bro, yep. Sure I house you, but I won't supply you a meal though. Not really. Keep your points slow into yourself. I dropped out with a 4.0. Have a way with words, heavy mental, dental method of every single sound since you arrest me in development. I'm the intelligent black speaker, with a sound that bangs every relevant black speaker. As a black dog, there's sort of voice when you rap you. Blacker than important employees. Instead of it's fight night, cause we'll fence your points. I ain't right, right. You know I got you head like light bright. A big stigmas or visions or split decision. I can tell your bird is lying, and I don't rip with prison. Style soft like a pillow, for real though. Black hand like a thriller. Style soft like a pillow, for real though. Black hand like a thriller. Style soft like a pillow, for real though. Black hand like a thriller. Style soft like a killer, for real though. Black hand like a thriller. Bob Dylan on the fence, will I sell out or buy it? Either way, I'm indebted to science. Pure disease with points on grip. Don't want this block unless enough money is spent. Here we shook the scandal. The pistol grip pumps do work, cause the vandals look handled. Hope hits you harder than an anvil. The way I wrote my epitaph face on the face of that handbill. Bill, that's my space like the Jetsons. Throwing my space with my line as a reference. Y'all leave hookers with a dime in your preference. I'm hard side poppy, I don't whine or regret shit. A question, how's the feel to feel the house like the speaker? Plus the wheel that shouts for the weaker and the poorer. Hand black like the Morris. And I ran to the back for 7 years and 4 scores. They style soft like a pillow, for real though. Black hand like a thriller. Style soft like a pillow, for real though. Black hand like a gorilla. Style soft like a pillow, for real though. Black hand like a gorilla. Style soft like a pillow, for real though. Black hand like a gorilla. I said get him, I'm done with dead rhythms. The number one question is can the heads mix them? I got vendettas with ice chains and grills, but I flame with skills that might pain your illness. Fuck writers block, I block fighters on the Reggie Larry. I'm said to marry fighter talk with a deathly berry like over the battle. They say the warrior's godlike. This means you're a civilian looking at a dog fight. Cold in the frostbite, I walk in strikes and run blocks. Like Pac-Man, but with more rubber than Dunlop. Who's grindy? Then again, who's rhyming? Ask your girl, she blew my tower like Boots Riley. Now food's grindy, catch me when the flow's dumb. Like it was 88, ripping lead patches off a homespun. No one touch him, so I'm taking my marker to get my point across like an atheist archer.